Thank you very much. It's certainly a pleasure to have the opportunity to present this material that was generated from the Office of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. This project really started in about late 2005 when a major policy shift occurred at the American College, in that it was determined that since OBs do a fair amount of primary care, that immunization should be, let's say, stepped up a notch and should become a major focus of obstetricians and gynecologists. As liaison to ACIP, for about 10 years, I've listened to the pediatricians and the family physicians complain about the obstetricians not doing anything. So it finally sort of got under my skin. We started agitating to get this going. And this actually, the results of this survey, which was mailed to obstetricians in September, October, and a second mailing in December, January, as to the current practices. And I'd like to recognize Megan Letty, Bretta Anderson, and Jay Shulkin of the college for massaging this data. The American College, as I said, has encouraged the provision of primary care by the fellows, and that immunizations are an important part of the primary care, and OBGs can really play an important role. Visits of physicians for women under the age of 50, over half of them are to their obstetrician gynecologist. So the obstetrician gynecologist has an opportunity then, over a long period of time, and particularly in pregnancy, when you have anywhere from 8 to 15 visits, to get up to speed on these things. Certainly relevant, we know that certain disease entities in the pregnant women are severe, like influenza. It kicks you into a high-risk category immediately, and the Achilles heel of pregnancy is the lungs. New vaccine, Gardasil quadrivalent HPV, is particularly relevant to OBGs and protects against cervical cancer and the whole HPV spectrum disease. And the idea is that it was anticipated that obstetricians would clomp on to providing quadrivalent HPV vaccine, and if they're doing that, then why not other things like flu and Tdap and hepatitis B? And that was the goal that we had. So we investigated whether or not obstetricians are accepting immunization, a primary care practice, as part of their role. A 37-question survey was sent to 771 ACOG fellows who are part of the ACOG Collaborative Research Network, and this is a group of people who have agreed to answer questionnaires. So as you know, professional organizations periodically put out questionnaires, and this is the group. And these contain questions regarding demographics, vaccination practices, knowledge and beliefs regarding vaccine, like HPV and influenza, and then opinions of their immunization education. A similar survey, which I'm not reporting on, was sent to 4,500 obstetricians in District 5 of ACOG, which is Indiana, Kentucky, Michigan, Ohio, and Ontario. The analysis included only currently practicing physicians, so it wasn't retired physicians. As I mentioned, the people in this collaborative ambulatory research network are throughout the U.S. and Canada and voluntarily participate in ACOG research studies, and this group was created to facilitate the examination of patterns of clinical practice, as well as assess the needs for and development of educational materials. It is a representative sample of OBGYNs who are fellows of ACOG. Greater than 90% of practicing obstetricians are members of ACOG, and they are similar in age, gender ratio, and geographic location as the general population. This slide looks at a number of key demographics. The primary practice, general OBGYN, and about 78%, about 12% to gynecology only, 4.9 maternal fetal medicine, 2.3 reproductive endocrinology, 1.3 urogynecology, pediatric adolescent gynecology 0.5, and obstetrics only 0.3. And you can see the location is largely urban, non-inner city, and suburban locations, although there are about equal number of urban, inner city, and rural locations. The practice patterns of those who see adolescents as and women of childbearing age and postmenopausal women is listed here. As far as vaccine practices, the majority, about 80%, administer vaccines in their office. And it's of interest, the percentage of those who give vaccines that administer a variety of vaccines, HPV 91%, administer, averaging 20.59 injections per month. Influenza, 74%. A previous study in the Green Journal in 1999 suggested at the max about 35-39% were giving influenza, and as we heard before, the CDC statistics of a number of about 12%, which is even lower. So seeing this type of thing, maybe the policy of if you're doing quadrivalent HPV vaccine and you have it set up in your office, now let's do the other things because you're all ready to go. Tdap 29.9%, and I would take a little different tap as far as recommendations, although the American Academy of Pediatricians and the American College of Obstetricians say it's okay to give a Tdap postpartum. Both organizations recommend it be given during pregnancy. And we think that you protect the mom and you protect the baby. You get a two-for-one deal, just like Walmart, two-for-one. Protect mom, protect the baby. And if you can't do it then give it postpartum, or give it antepartum, give it sometime, but give it. You see MMR 28.1, largely that's going to be postpartum as well as varicella. And you can see we really have a long way to go with pneumococcal vaccine. And herpes zoster shingles is sort of scratching the surface. 91% of those who administer vaccines in their office offer HPV vaccine. Reported 16.94% of patients inquire about HPV vaccine, and 15% of the patients refuse vaccine. Question that was posed, why do patients refuse HPV vaccine? Overall response indicated that financial costs are the strongest barrier to patient acceptance of HPV vaccine. Majority, 84%, agreed or strongly agreed that the financial cost of the vaccine was a reason why their patients refused it. And this question was, routine screening for vaccine-preventable diseases falls outside the routine practice of the OBGYN. And so what's this saying? This isn't for OBs, and you can see that some 65% agree or strongly disagree that that is not the case. About 15% were neutral, and then you had about 18-19% that said that was in fact. So the vast majority feel that vaccines fall under purview of the obstetrician gynecologist. I thought this was really an interesting slide. This is, should HPV be mandated? This is sort of the perfect storm. You have the same amount strongly agree and strongly disagree and are neutral. And then you have the same number that agree and disagree, which basically means there's really a lot of flux to question out in the general population, at least for these obstetricians. The question is, why not mandate HPV vaccine? Again, respondents indicated the financial costs play an important role in the acceptance of HPV vaccine. 66% agreed or strongly agreed that the financial cost to the patient was a reason why HPV vaccine should not be mandated. Lack of reimbursement was the next most agreed or strongly agreed with reason not to mandate, with 35% agreeing or strongly agreeing. I thought this was really interesting, and this certainly you can go back to your medical school days or nursing days. OBGYN's view of their immunization training. 68% rated their training and immunization in medical school as barely adequate, inadequate, or non-existent. 77% rated training in residency to be barely adequate, inadequate, or non-existent. So there's really a lot of education right at this level that really needs to be done. We asked, this is another interesting question, we asked respondents to fill in the following blanks. Gardasil protects against blank forms of HPV that cause blank percent of cervical cancer and blank percent of genital warts. Now, the correct answer is 4, 70, and 90, okay? For those of you that don't know it, and I'm sure there are one or two in here. Most, 88%, knew that HPV vaccine protected against four forms of HPV, 6, 11, 16, and 18. However, fewer respondents knew that the vaccine prevents 70% of cervical cancer, only 40.6%, and that 90% of genital warts was prevented, again, 41%. So even though there's tons and tons of information that's out there in the last year and a half, you still have 40% really not knowing what it's doing. 22.9% filled in three blanks correctly, only 22%. And only a small minority got all three questions wrong. You know, that's sort of, does the sun come up tomorrow? I mean, it's... Hepatitis B was interesting. In question, hepatitis B vaccine is recommended for persons in high-risk occupations. 99% said they recommend that. Newborns, 86.4%. I'm very disappointed in that because the newborn dose has been part of immunization since 1992, and therefore they really should be knowing that because it's standard of care to test for hepatitis B serology in the antepartum course. Adolescents, 77.2, and pregnant women with known risk factors, 70.3. There are 23 risk factors for hepatitis B. We routinely administer hepatitis B practically. Everybody walks in the door that's pregnant because they're going to fall into one of those risk categories. One of the risk categories, if you screen a person for an STD, that's a risk category. Every pregnant woman gets screened for an STD. Therefore, everyone should have vaccine. 87% agreed with the CDC that influenza-associated morbidity and mortality are increased for otherwise healthy women who contract influenza in the second or third trimester. And 85% agreed with the CDC that all pregnant women should receive influenza vaccine. Vaccines in pregnancy, majority agreed with current CDC recommendations. Vaccines below, 90% for flu, 64% Hep B, and Tdap, 60%. And then a small percentage believe the following vaccines are safe to administer in pregnancy, although not currently recommended. HPV, 16%, varicella, 7.2, and rubella, MMR, 2.6. I certainly hope they get up to speed with the varicella and with the MMR. I think eventually, HPV will be approved for or will be used in pregnancy. Another question, what would help improve OBG's ability to administer vaccine? Again, free or low-cost vaccines. Informational material for patients, even though they should know that information is available at the CDC website for every vaccine, and it's available in numerous languages also. And certainly the VIS is great informed consent. You can use it as that. Seminar grand rounds, in-service program. And then 86% indicated their practice would benefit from a CME course in immunization. That's certainly where we come in. So in conclusion, certain immunizations like HPV and influenza are being incorporated into OBGYN practices. The goal of ACOG is to get additional vaccines into their practice. And as you all know, only HPV vaccine is a category B. Every other vaccine is a category C, mainly because the companies have not done the animal studies. And we use influenza, which is a category C. There are a little over 4 million pregnancies in the U.S. a year, and currently somewhere between 1 and 2 million are getting influenza vaccine and get it year after year. It's perfectly safe. Though a majority rated their immunization training in medical school and residency to be barely adequate or less, OBGs are knowledgeable with current vaccine recommendations. That may be the result of activity through ACOG as physicians learn through their professional organizations what currently is in practice. Views on mandating HPV vaccine are split. Cost is a factor in disagreeing with the mandating the vaccine, and cost is thought to be a factor in patient refusal of HPV vaccine. So I thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Dr. Gall. I think we have time for one or two questions. Okay, well, I know the time is almost up. You have a question?
Do you feel that ACOG
this is for Dr. Gall.
I think the answer to your question is definitely yes. There is a educational effort that is underway at ACOG to get information to members. It's content material which has been languishing in the bowels of ACOG, which should be out to the members hopefully by May on content. The content material, which is really important. Also, ACOG is in the process of developing a toolkit so that those offices that are interested in initiating vaccine programs can basically use that type of a toolkit. I think that it is an important thing, and we think that really the thing that leads it is HPV vaccine, because that's something that human papillomavirus and its whole spectrum of diseases is something obstetricians understand, and that if you're doing it with one, why not plug in the rest of it? Sort of going with the whole business, we really have to get behind the vaccine for adults program. CDC has been focused on vaccines for children for a long time, and I think that's important. But the big, you know, there are less than 100 children that die of vaccine-preventable diseases, and there's about 60,000 adults, plus all of the injuries from illness and long-term care. So we have to get behind a vaccine for adults program, both at the federal and the state level.